You're a bright young man. This monkey business is in your blood, under your skin. You're not getting out, you're just getting in. You're only getting started. I've every faith in you. And one day in the future, it'll be you sitting here in my place, telling some young Turk the facts of life.
And they are, Mr. Temple.
You're born, you take shit. Get out in the world, you take more shit. Climb a little higher, take less shit. Till one day you're up in the rarefied atmosphere and you've forgotten what shit even looks like. Welcome to the layer cake, son.
Hello, welcome back once again to another episode of the File and Claw audiobook archive presentation of Triumphant Plutocracy, a.k.a. Imperial Washington, the story of American public life from 1870 to 1920, written by Richard Franklin Pettigrew and published in 1922. These are, I'm going to say essentially, the memoirs of the first senator from the state of South Dakota, who was right there in the thick of things during the Gilded Age. He was in the government at the time when the captains of industry, those great pioneers of American ingenuity, or the robber barons, you know, whatever you think of them, they were really consolidating their grip on America and the government and the economy and all the resources and the transportation of the nation and subverting it to their own agenda. Now, Pettigrew writes with what I feel is a great deal of authority because he was right in there and he saw what happened. He didn't make a lot of friends in Washington, but that's because he wouldn't go along with the program and he didn't pull many punches, either both in his political career and in this book. So we've been able to hew some very interesting gems of knowledge out of this mountain of material here that we're covering, and I think this book has been very insightful because it's good to have an insider's view. And not just any old insider, but we're talking about a senator. This is a senator who is essentially telling you this stuff. So it's very authoritative. I'm not going to get into any kind of extended intro today. Let's get to the material. Before we do that, of course, I'll run through, as always, I will be doing my very best to keep this recording down to 1 hour in length, if at all possible. That's for easy digestion and consumption of the material. I'll be spelling any last names because I butcher the pronunciation of them sometimes, And I find it easier for people to go back and look up these characters in this book if you know how to spell their name. Some of them aren't very well known or remembered from American history, so you might need to do some searching. If there's any footnotes in the book, which there really haven't been so far, I'll read them into the reading as long as they're not just a citation. Otherwise, the only other thing I've been doing is Pettigrew's putting in a few charts into this book. So I've been posting those on the website, which, speaking of, you can find at fileandclaw322.wordpress.com. Or as the backup, you can always go on to twitter.com, and my handle is at fileandclaw322. And from my profile, you'll always be able to find a link to the latest incarnation of the website, because you never know when I might have to cut and move it. So there you go. Other than that, kick back, relax, and let's see what Pettigrew has to say now. Alright, so sorry I hadn't mentioned this before, but the last 9 chapters have basically been it's part 1, I guess the book's broken into a few parts. Part 1, the economic power at home. So we're going to get on now with part 2 of the book, titled The Machinery of Government. And this is chapter 10, Who Made the Constitution? I have written in some detail of the economic changes and of the changes in economic policy that have occurred in the United States during the past 50 years. The first year that I went to Washington, in 1870, the population of Chicago was 298,977. Today, in 1920, it is 2,701,705. The population of Detroit was 79,577. Today, it is 993,739. The population of Minneapolis was 13,006. Today, it is 380,582. The population of Dakota was 14,181. Today, it is 1,281,569. I have watched the Middle West grow from a sparsely settled wilderness, the home of Indians and of buffaloes, to the greatest center of agriculture and of industry in the world. I have watched the public domain slip out of the hands of the people and into the hands of speculators, of corporations, and of monopolies. I have seen the bankers, the trust magnates, and the masters of transportation and other forms of monopoly rise from obscurity to their present position of domination in public affairs. I have watched the growth of the plutocracy, the few who rule industry, the government, and the press, because they are rich. In the halls of the Capitol at Washington, I have watched these plutocrats, through their representatives on the floor of the Senate and the House, erect the governmental machinery that they required for the preservation of their power. Step by step and move by move, I fought the system of imperialism, which the McKinley administration enabled them to establish as the accepted policy of the country. And that last name is McKinley, but he's the president. You should be able to look that up pretty easily. Continuing, the fight lasted 12 years. When it was over, the interests that I had opposed were the triumphant masters of the field. When I entered the Senate, I did not understand what it was that I was facing. When I left the Senate, because Mark Hanna, last name Hanna, and the forces behind Mark Hanna willed that I should leave, I knew that the forms of our government and the machinery of its administration were established and maintained for the benefit of the class that held the economic and political power. I realized that the machinery of government had been constructed by the ruling economic class to preserve
and guarantee its own economic interests. Documents like the Constitution, which I, as a child, had been taught to regard as almost divine in their origin, stood before me for what they were, plans prepared by businessmen to stabilize business interests. At the time that our Constitution was drawn up, Adam Smith wrote of the government in the quote-unquote mother country, from Wealth of Nations, Book 5, Chapter 1, published in 1776, quote, "Civil government, as far as it is instituted for the security of property, is in reality instituted for the defense of the rich against the poor, or of those who have some property against those who have none at all." Unquote. Again, he stated, Book 1, Chapter 10, quote, "Whenever the legislature attempts to regulate the differences between masters and their workmen, its counselors are always the masters." Unquote. Concerning this same epoch, a well-known modern historian writes, quote, "During the period we are discussing, from 1760 to 1832, the classes that possessed authority in the state and the classes that had acquired the new wealth, landlords, churchmen, judges, manufacturers, one and all understood by government the protection of society from the fate that had overtaken the privileged classes in France." Unquote. That's from that's from the town laborer, J.L. and B. Hammond, New York, Longmans, 1917, page 321. And I'll try to find that book and throw up a link to that. Continuing now. "It was this government by landlords and manufacturers that the framers of the Constitution knew, and they knew no other. Their idea of government was the British idea, a machine for protecting the rich against the poor, a device for safeguarding and defending privilege against the clamorous and revolutionary demands of the populace. Their goal was the protection of the property interest, and they drew the Constitution with that end in view. Furthermore, it was the leading businessmen of the colonists in their own persons who drew up the Constitution and forced through its ratification. The movement for the Constitution," writes Charles A. Beard, last name B-E-A-R-D, the distinguished student of American government, quote, "was originated and carried through principally by four groups of personality interests, which had been adversely affected under the Articles of Confederation: money, public securities, manufacturers, and trade and shipping." Unquote. And that from An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, New York, Macmillan, 1914, page 324. These events transpired nearly a century and a half ago, and ever since that time we have been building up the kind of government that bankers, manufacturers, and merchants needed for their enrichment. Look around. How could you disagree with that assessment? Oh, man. Bankers are doing well as ever. I mean, they're up into the trillions. Trillions in wealth. And every time they go bust on their gambling, they just go to the government and get a bailout. Every time. How are the manufacturers doing? Well, they've had laws passed to where they can ship out all their manufacturing to countries where they only have to pay people a few pennies. Some third world nation where children get to work on it after we did away with child labor in the early 1900s. So I guess they're doing okay. Their status quo maintains. How are the merchants doing? Well, hell, they're the only people left doing anything in America anyway. So I guess they're doing pretty okay. Let's continue on with the book. "This point is so fundamental to a proper understanding of what I have to say about the machinery of American government that I desire to emphasize it. School teachers talk to children and public men harangue their constituents as though the Constitution were a document drawn to establish human liberty. By these means, our ideas as to the intention of the framers of the Constitution have been utterly distorted. Anyone who wishes to know the facts should examine the Journal of the Constitutional Convention. There the record is as plain as the road at noonday. The Constitution was not drawn up to safeguard liberty. Its framers had property rights in their mind's eye and property deeds in their pockets, and its most enthusiastic supporters were the leading bankers, manufacturers, and traders of the Federated States. The Constitution was made to protect the rights of property and not the rights of man. These facts are neither secret nor hidden. They are a part of the public record that may be consulted in any first-class library. Properly understood, they furnish the intellectual key that will open the mind to an appreciation of many of the most important events that have occurred in the United States during the past century. The convention that framed the Constitution of the United States convened at Philadelphia in 1787 behind closed doors. All of the delegates were sworn to secrecy.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
Madison reported the proceedings of the convention in longhand, and his notes were purchased in 1837 by Congress and published by the government nearly half a century after the convention had finished its work. These notes disclose the forces that dominated the work of the convention and show that the object which the leaders of the convention had in view was not to create a democracy or a government of the people, but to establish a government by the property classes in the interests of the rights of property rather than the rights of man. All through the debates ran one theme: how to secure a government not by the people and for the people, but by the classes and for the classes, with the lawyers in control. Jefferson was not a member of the convention. As the author of the Declaration of Independence, he was not wanted in the convention, and so he was sent to France on a diplomatic mission. I will give two extracts from these proceedings to illustrate this point. They are typical and are as follows. Madison, on page 78, quotes Sherman of Connecticut as saying, quote, "The people should have as little to do as may be about the government. They want information and are constantly liable to be misled." Unquote. Again, on page 115, Mr. Jerry, his last name G-E-R-R-Y, is quoted as follows, quote, "Hence, in Massachusetts, the worst men get into the legislature. Several members of that body had lately been convicted of infamous crimes. Men of indigence, ignorance, and baseness spare no pains, however dirty, to carry their point against men who are superior to the artifices practiced." Unquote. This is the burden of the debates through page after page of the two volumes. The chief contention in the Constitutional Convention was over representation in the United States Senate. The smaller states feared that they would be dominated by the larger ones, and after much debate, it was agreed that each state, no matter what its wealth or population, should have two votes in the Senate of the United States, while the House of Representatives should represent the people, and the number of delegates from each state should be in proportion to the population. As a concession to the larger states, a provision was inserted requiring that all money bills should originate in the House of Representatives, and this was considered important in view of the fact that the states of small area and small population, such as Delaware and Rhode Island, had an equal voice with large states like Virginia and Pennsylvania in the Senate of the United States. Huh, interesting. The southern states believed they had obtained protection for their peculiar institution, slavery, by securing representation in the House of Representatives for the slave population. At the same time, the southern slaveholders and the northern slave traders combined to secure the insertion of a clause, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1, permitting the slave trade to continue until 1808. At the time of framing the Constitution, and for many years thereafter, it was supposed and intended that the Senate should represent the states while the House represented the people. No vested interest ever thought of gaining control of the Senate for the purpose of advancing the commercial or financial position of any combination, corporation, or individual. It was not until a third of a century after the adoption of the Constitution that the southern states began to look to the Senate for the protection of their interests and to insist upon the admission of a slave state whenever a free state asked for admission to the Union. The immediate purpose behind the creation of a Senate that was not elected by the people, but that came from the state legislatures and thus spoke in the name of states rather than of masses of citizens, was the protection of the small colonies against the large ones. The interests that dominated both the small and large colonies, however, were the business interests. Therefore, the struggle between those who wanted one form of Senate and those who wanted another was a struggle between contending and competing business groups. It was not in any sense a struggle between the champions of liberty and the advocates of property rights. Interesting. So, I guess that kind of makes sense, right? You wanted the Senate to be the equal playing ground for the small colonies against the large ones, and then later on it turns into being totally dominated by property interests, you know, or big businesses or corporations. This is a very interesting chapter. Here it's probably not something you hear very much of, you know. I know coming from the libertarian ethos movement, the Constitution is, like you said, a divine, you know, almost like some kind of divine scripture. And Pettigrew here, Rich Pettigrew, is remarking that, you know, the only reason you can come to that conclusion is by ignoring the economic forces that were contending at this time. And let's not forget, most of these people were either businessmen or traders or shippers, as we've looked at in certain episodes in the History of America's 1% podcast. And I'm going to say that was, we covered that specifically in episode number 3, 4, and 5 of the podcast. And a lot of these guys were lawyers, and they were classically trained. I mean, they were British, you know, ancestry, classically trained in the way and the laws of Britain, which, you know, it's not hard to look at that and see how their system is constantly propped up in aristocracy. So this is very interesting and an interesting way to look at it. And again, as I always say, you know, the truth will follow no ideology. So I bet it's probably a little hard to swallow if you're coming from the libertarian side. But just think, you know, be able to look at it and think about it and dissect it, see if there's any truth. He's listed a few different books here, and especially I would recommend the now published. Of course, it did take a half century after the Constitution was in for the, like you said, the notes of that, what actually happened in the constitutional debates to be published. And you think old Nancy was bad. The Founding Fathers really gave her a run for the money, yeah? But let's continue on with the book here. This fact is made evident by an examination of the interests of these men who made up the Constitutional Convention of 1787. There were 55 delegates present in the convention. A majority were lawyers. Most of them came from towns. There was not one farmer, mechanic, or laborer among them. 5-6 had property interests. Of the 55 members, 40 owned revolutionary scrip. 14 were land speculators, 24 were money lenders, 11 were merchants, and 15 were slaveholders. Washington, the big man of the convention, was a slaveholder, land speculator, and a large scrip owner. And Jefferson was in France. The Constitution, as framed by the convention, says nothing about the rights of man. It contains no guarantee of free speech, a free press, a free assemblage, or of religious liberty. It breathes no single hint of freedom. It was made by men who believed in the English theory that all governments are created to protect the rights of property in the hands of those who do not produce it. Ah ha ha, interesting. And that is certainly true. Everybody loves the Constitution for freedom of speech and freedom of the press and freedom to assemble and religious liberty and the right to reasonable search and seizure and all this. But you need to remember that that came well after the Constitution was written, and it's not even part of the Constitution. Those were amendments, the Bill of Rights, right, that came after. And pretty much when you dig into that, it seems like those were introduced because the Constitution wasn't going to be ratified without a little, some breadcrumbs tossed out to the people there. So interesting, interesting. Let's continue on. The revolutionary scrip paper money to finance the Revolutionary War had been used to pay for supplies and to pay the wages of the men that did the fighting. In the years that followed the war, the scrip had been bought up by the financiers and great landowners and their attorneys for about 9 cents on the dollar. The Constitution, as adopted, made it worth 100 cents on the dollar. This is but one of the many facts which proved that the Constitution, as drawn up by the convention, was made to protect the rights of property rather than the rights of man. Throughout the document, the framers were careful to guard against too much democracy. The government was erected in three parts, legislative, executive, and judicial, each with a check on the other two. The House of Representatives alone was elected directly by the people, but all of its legislative acts were subject to revision or rejection by the Senate, the members of which were to be selected not by popular vote, but by the vote of the state legislatures. Thus, even the legislative branch of the government did not represent the popular will. Oh, interesting. I can totally see that. We know, if you've listened to the History of America's 1% podcast, especially in the beginning couple of chapters around the Revolution and prior, that the state or colonial legislative bodies were totally dominated by the leading economic interests of the time. Absolutely. So if these guys are electing the people to go to the Senate, and the Senate has a check on all legislation in the House of Representatives, either to, revise or reject laws, legislation, can you not see how that kind of stovepiping and control works? Man, this is some deep history here. Let's continue on. If the legislative branch had been responsible to the people, there was still the president, elected not by the vote of the people, but the vote of electors, who were elected by the people. And last of all, and by no means the least, from the point of view of the vested interest, there was the Supreme Court, its members selected by the President, confirmed by the Senate, sitting for life. Over these Supreme Judges, the people could not exercise even an indirect control. This was the Constitution drawn up while Thomas Jefferson was in France. It was submitted to the states for ratification, and the states refused to accept it. In all probability, it never would have been ratified had Thomas Jefferson not returned from France and thrown his great influence in favor of the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, that was added to the Constitution by its business backers as the necessary price of its adoption by the people. Oh yeah. Article 1 of these amendments reads, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Unquote. Article 4 of the amendments provides, quote, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall be issued upon, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Unquote. These are the principal guarantees of liberty inserted into the Constitution after the Convention of Businessmen had finished its work, and inserted because the people insisted upon having them there. Even at that, the Constitution is a lukewarm document. In it there are no such burning words as those written by Thomas Jefferson 13 years earlier and published as the Declaration of Independence. Quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created free and equal, and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its power in such form as shall seem to them most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Unquote. It was not until 1861, when Abraham Lincoln delivered his first inaugural address, that the right of revolution was definitely proclaimed by a responsible statesman acting under the Constitution. This country, Lincoln said on that occasion, quote, with its institutions belongs to the people who inhabit it. Whenever they shall grow weary of the existing government, they can exercise their constitutional right of amendment, or their revolutionary right to dismember or overthrow it. Unquote. That revolutionary right, so clearly proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence and so emphatically stated by Lincoln, remains today the avenue left to the American people as a means of escape from the intolerable plutocratic tyranny that the Constitution has set up. Ooh, oh, rich man calling for revolution back in 1920. No wonder he didn't have any friends in Congress. The Constitution is the fundamental law of the United States. It was drawn up 134 years ago by a convention consisting of businessmen and their lawyer retainers. It was a document designed to protect property rights, and through the century and a quarter that it has endured, it has served its purpose so well that it stands today, not only as the chief bulwark of American privilege and vested wrong, but as the greatest document ever designed by man for the safeguarding of the many in their work of exploiting and robbing the many. And that's the end of chapter 10, and I bet that's not going to sit well with many people. But there it is. And he laid out a very interesting case. It was fairly easy to follow. And I'd say it maybe deserves some more attention, some further research. Let's dig in and take a look. Just because an idea sounds foreign or goes against the grain doesn't mean we should instantly dismiss it. Let's check it out. Let's do some research. I'll try to find some books on this. I mean, obviously, if he wrote this in 1920 and he's quoting from older text, there must be somewhere where he got this from, so well, I'll see what I can dig up. But since we're only a half hour in here, let's jump into chapter 11.
Alright, this is part 3, The Machinery of Government, chapter 11, Lawyers. The Constitution of the United States was made by businessmen. The work of managing and directing the government machinery that has been erected in pursuance of the Constitution has always been placed almost exclusively in the hands of lawyers, who sit in the legislatures and make the laws, sit in the executive chairs and enforce the laws, and sit on the bench and interpret the law. Lawyers dominate the city, state, and national governments to an astonishing degree. In one sense, they are the government, at least insofar as manipulating its machinery is concerned. The lawyers have become a governing caste in the United States. Their official position is out of all proportion to their number. The total number of, quote, lawyers, judges, and justices, unquote, as given in the census of 1910, the latest one available at this writing, was 114,704. The same volume of the census reports that there were more than 38,167,000 gainfully occupied persons in the United States. That would make 3 lawyers for each 1,000 of the gainfully occupied population. Therefore, if the lawyers had their proportional share of the governing positions, they would get less than 1/3 of 1% of the government jobs. The actual situation is far different. In the affairs of government, particularly of the federal government, the lawyer plays a leading part. He is only 1/300th of the gainfully occupied population, but he is the majority of those upon whom falls the duty of making and enforcing laws. That's very interesting. Think about that. I wonder what it looks like today. Somebody should do a study on that. I'll just throw that out there. How many lawyers sit in the Congress today? God, could you even imagine trying to pull all the bureaucrats? There's too many. It's an impossible task. But it could be interesting to see how many heads of agencies are lawyers, how many cabinet postings were lawyers, how many judges are lawyers. All of them, probably. Okay, let's continue on with the book. An interesting note, and all the way back in 1910, these guys were running the show, and they probably still are. So keep that in mind. And one more little tidbit, I guess, before I get back, is that remember in this book, Pettigrew has already covered that our legal system, right? It comes from the old English traditions, which were always about protecting the aristocracy. So what does that tell you? Let's continue on with the book here. Take the situation in the federal Congress. There has never been a time during the 50 years that I have known Washington when the lawyers constituted less than half of the membership of both houses of Congress. Usually they made up 2/3 of the membership. The proportion varies, but the principle holds. The present Congress, the 65th, reports in the House 263 lawyers out of a total of 388 who gave their occupations. No occupations were given for 47. In the Senate, there are 60 lawyers out of a total of 89 senators who reported their occupations. The census shows that the lawyers constitute only 3 in every 1,000 of the gainful population. In the Senate, they are in the proportion of 674 per 1,000, and in the House, in the proportion of 677 in the 1,000. Thus, 2/3 of our national lawmakers are lawyers. The same thing holds true of our presidents. Since the United States has become a government by the corporations, their presidential candidates have almost invariably been lawyers. Harrison, as president, was a lawyer, and reputed to be a good one.
He had been preceded in that high office by Grover Cleveland, a lawyer from Buffalo, New York. Harrison was followed by Cleveland. Cleveland was followed by another lawyer, McKinley, who was elected and assassinated, and thus Theodore Roosevelt, who was his vice president and not a lawyer, accidentally became president. He was succeeded by another lawyer, Taft, who was not a good lawyer. He had neither the judgment nor the ability to make a good lawyer, and he was therefore a very satisfactory representative of the predatory and exploiting corporations which, during all my time in public life, have been the real force in control of the government. Damn, Pettigrew's laying it out right there. Yeah, this guy's not pulling any punches. Taft was followed by Wilson, a lawyer, and after his 8 years, the people elected Harding, another lawyer, giving him a plurality of more than 6 million of votes. There is no question of party politics involved. Of all the presidents that I have known, two were Democrats, Cleveland and Wilson. The rest were Republicans. With the exception of Roosevelt, all of them since Garfield, and including Garfield, have been lawyers. The lawyers have an even higher percentage among the successful presidential candidates than they have among the members of Congress. When it comes to the courts, the whole field is in the possession of the lawyers, who have built up a system of exalting the law above everything else in the land, life, happiness, and liberty included. They have worked out a quote-unquote precedent under which no one may become a judge unless he has previously been a lawyer. As a matter of practical fact, it is not necessary that a judge should be a lawyer. On the contrary, a lawyer trained under the present system is not fit to be a judge, but the thing has been worked out in such a way that all of the judges are lawyers. The position of the lawyers in the government is absurd in view of their small numerical importance. There are only a little more than 100,000 of them in the country, of more than 100 millions, yet they make up more than 2/3 of the membership of both houses of Congress. The majority of the state legislatures, most of the governors, all of the prosecuting attorneys, most of the presidents, and all of the judges. The lawyers enact the laws, interpret the laws, and enforce the laws. The government is a lawyer government, and we are a lawyer-ridden country. Oh, man. This was back in 1922. Think about it. Now it's nothing but litigation, man. You can't turn around without somebody suing somebody for something. These guys have taken over. It sounds like they were in charge back then, but now they've really taken over. Isn't this history interesting? Continuing with the book now. Then there comes a question. If the businessmen of the United States run the government, as I have asserted that they do, how comes it that they are willing to let the lawyers hold all of the important public positions? The answer to that question is very simple. Because the lawyers do it so well. If the lawyers failed to do what the businessmen want done, the businessmen would soon put an end to their domination of the political machinery. The lawyers know that as well as the businessmen. But the lawyers are kept in their present position because they are such splendid representatives of the predatory interests. A lawyer, by his training and by his practice, is calculated to serve the ruling class of the country, and where the rulers can get able servants, there is no reason why they should do the work themselves. They have ample resources. They can afford to pay, and with the lawyers at hand to do their work, they are as well served as though they served themselves. The lawyers are not experts in government, but in debauching and corrupting and crippling the government in the interest of those who pay them their fees. So here they sit, in the legislatures, in the executive officers, and on the bench, running the government in the interest of those who are plundering the people. Business interests support and finance their lawyer handymen because these lawyers are able to do what the business world wants done.
The lawyers have been developed into a class of professional manipulators and wreckers of government machinery because they are trained from the outset to regard the interests of their clients as of greater moment than the public interest. This is going to get interesting. All right, here we go. Here we go. A man, to become a good lawyer, must have spent his life studying precedent. What is precedent but the preservation of the status quo? And what is the status quo but the wisdom of yesterday? The good lawyer is therefore the lawyer who is able to preserve the shadow of yesterday and use it to darken the sunlight of today. The good lawyer, to educate himself, pores over the common law of England. Oh, there's that common law that all these people love. Like, oh, common law, it's so good. Hold on a second. Wait till you hear this. When his head is filled with 1,700 decisions handed down by judges who lived in the 17th century before the American colonies found the British rule intolerable, he fills up the chinks of his mind with Blackstone and with Kent's commentaries. He then studies what the judges, lawyers of the United States said during the past 100 years, and after that he is considered as prepared to defend the interests of the exploiters of America. This precedent-fed human being is valuable to the great interest for 3 reasons. First, because his study of precedent has rendered him incapable of thinking into the future and has thus made him a natural protector of things as they are. Second, because the tradition of property rights inherited from the past can best be preserved through such a class of dead-hand experts. Third, because the lawyer, under the ethics of his profession, is the only man who can take a bribe and call it a fee. Wow. That really, man, doesn't that just lay it out? To all those people out there who always say, well, we just got to pass a law. You know, we'll pass a law to end corruption. Stop it. Stop it. Look at this. All laws are essentially written by these people whose heads are filled from the time they enter the profession of being a lawyer who writes the laws, who interpret the laws, and who enforce the laws. These guys are all ingrained. Call what you call brainwashed, whatever you want to call it. Their natural bias is to enforce the status quo. And we know what that is. And that's where we are today. The perpetual motion machine, folks, at work. Let's continue on with the book. The real work of the world is done by those who envisage the future and prepare for it. Such an ability is the first essential in the statesman or in any other person who assumes to play a role in the direction of human affairs. The lawyer finds it virtually impossible to look ahead. He has been trained to move forward with his eyes over his shoulder. Any ruling class, depending for its profits on some special privilege, like the ownership of land or of machinery, must see to it that these special privileges are not interfered with, otherwise its source of profit may be destroyed. At one time, under the feudal system, it was the church that acted as the policeman for the landlord, keeping the tenants quiet with threats of dire punishment in the hereafter in case they interfered with the sacred person or with the still more sacred property of their overlords. That function at the present time has been taken over by the lawyers, who threaten the penalties of criminal codes and of espionage acts for those who transgress the sacred precincts in which the property of their clients is enclosed. All of this work is done by the simple method of allowing one man, for himself and for his heirs forever, certain corner lots and choice quarter sections without which his fellows cannot continue to make a living. The world marches by his door, and for the privilege of doing so, it pays the property holder his rent.
The lawyer has studied the precedents established by the land-holding aristocracy of Great Britain. From them, he has derived the common law, and to that he has added tens of thousands of pages of statutes which are designed to perfect the system the land-holding aristocracy of Great Britain has worked so hard to establish. The traditions of English civilization are traditions of wealthy landholders and manufacturers and bankers on the one hand, and on the and an overworked, exploited population of laborers on the other. No one who has seen the condition of the British workers can have any delusions as to the terrible way in which they have suffered under the quote-unquote property-first system of British society. It is this system that is being perpetuated in the United States by means of the Constitution, the laws, the courts, and the lawyers who are the handymen of big business in control of every important branch of the public service. That sounds pretty damning. You know, I used to, I came from the libertarian movement, and man, the Constitution was sacred. Law and order, right? That's what we need. With no laws, there's no liberty. Well, my friends, you start when you take a look at some of these arguments, which are ignored by certain movements, and including those on both sides, because you know what? Sometimes the progressives, you know, they don't want them to get too radical. They don't get too radical. Don't go too far outside the box. You don't need to tear down this garbage. What we need is more taxes. You know, more taxes will help everybody out. Just let the lawyers run everything. You'll be fine. Don't go too radical. Well, when you look at these arguments that are shunned sometimes by both sides, they paint quite an interesting picture, don't they? Don't you kind of get a little different view of what's going on? How did we get here? It's hard for people to explain sometimes. They can only look back so far. Some groups look back to FDR and the New Deal. Some can only go back to Reagan in the 80s. But Pettigrew here is looking real far back. He's looking back to the Constitution. He's looking back to the people who wrote it. He's looking at the time at the people who write the laws of the country, who enforce them, and who interpret them. And he's saying, where are these guys getting their perspective from? And he's looking way back to the aristocracies in Great Britain, the ones we supposedly threw off for being too oppressive and too overburdensome. Yet somehow it seems that we've managed to model our society and the way it runs on exactly such a system. Do you see any kind of disconnect there? I do. The more I read these type of books, the more it becomes apparent that these things have kind of been the trajectory the whole time, perhaps. I think it's a distinct possibility. Maybe this is what we saw, or what the people who found the country saw. A lot of them were lawyers. Is this where it's really all going? I don't know. I don't know. I don't think we can say for certain, of course. I mean, but as always, there's no smoking gun. There's just a trail and of dots, points, vectors of data, and it's up to you to connect them and see where they go. But let's continue on with the book. The lawyer makes a good servant of the ruling class because he spends his life making the world believe that the property rights are more important than the human rights. Again, he is useful because he may be bribed at almost any stage of his public career and may accept the bribe without losing his professional self-respect. During the 12 years that I was a member of the United States Senate, more than 2/3 of the members of both houses were lawyers, and those in the Senate were generally old lawyers who had spent their lives in the service of the great interests. So far as I know, these lawyers in both houses never hesitated to take a fee from any interest that wished to employ them. They satisfied their consciences by assuring themselves and their friends that no matter what the size of the fee, it did not influence their actions as lawmakers. I know personally of one senator who received a fee of $49,000 for representing one of the greatest of the industrial combinations in a case before a federal court. This man was as honest a lawyer as I ever knew. His vote could not have been purchased for any consideration. Yet, after he had received the $49,000 fee, if a question had come up which involved the interests of that corporation, or which was in the nature of an attack upon it, it is useless to insist that the thought of the fee would not have had at least some influence in determining what he should do and how he should vote. Senator Edmunds, last name E-D-M-U-N-D-S, of Vermont, was chairman of the Committee on the Judiciary during the 12 years that I was a member of the United States Senate. He reported the Sherman antitrust law from that committee. Afterward, the United States government began a suit against the Joint Traffic Association, which was a combination of 32 railroads running west from New York, on the ground that that combination was in violation of the Sherman antitrust law, the suit having been started before Judge Lacombe, the circuit judge of the District of New York. And his last name is Lacombe, that's L-A-C-O-M-B. The judge announced from the bench that he was disqualified from hearing the case because he was the owner of the stocks and bonds of the defendant railroad, and he said, in open court, that he believed every judge in the circuit was suffering from a like disqualification. The railroads had put their attorneys on the bench. It was finally found that Judge Wheeler, his last name W-H-E-E-L-E-R, just appointed through the influence of Senator Edmunds from the state of Vermont, was not the owner of stocks and bonds in the defendant railroads, and the railroads thereupon employed Edmunds to go before this judge, a creature of his, and tell the judge that the Sherman antitrust law was not being violated. No one knows how big a fee Edmunds received, but it created no comment, for it was well understood that a lawyer can be bought and call the purchase price of his opinions and convictions a fee. In the case of Foraker of Ohio and Senator Bailey of Texas, and those names Foraker, that's F-O-R-A-K-E-R, of Ohio, and Bailey of Texas, his last name B-A-I-L-E-Y. The amount of money paid them by the Standard Oil Company was so large, and the transaction was so undercover that it excited no great amount of comment until the newspapers took it up, and then the matter became so scandalous that the public thought it best to call a halt. These are only illustrations. It is a universal practice among the lawyers of both houses to take a fee from the industrial combinations whenever they can get it, and they boast among their fellow members if the fee is big enough to be worthwhile. This was the practice during the whole 12 years that I was in the Senate. From what I have said about the training of lawyers, it must be apparent that a lawyer cannot be a statesman. First, because he is trained to look backwards rather than forward, and second, because in order to be a statesman, it is necessary to have some appreciation of the general welfare, and the lawyer can only represent his clients and assist them to protect and defend property rights. How is it possible to produce statesmen under the conditions that prevail in the United States, or in any of the other great capitalist countries, for that matter? Under the system, the land, the resources, the means of transportation, and the money power are handed over to the favored few. They manipulate the government through their agents, the lawyers, and thus the machinery that should be employed to feed and care for the people is employed for the enrichment of the few at the expense of the many. It is the lawyers who have acted as the go-between. They have drawn the papers under which the riches of the nation have been placed in the hands of a few, who hold legal commissions that enable them to rob the many. Under these circumstances, it is not the general welfare that is uppermost in the minds of those responsible for the direction of public affairs, but the manipulation of public business in such a way as to add still more to the power of those who hold the special privileges of the nation. It is only in England and in the United States that the people have been satisfied to build up a ruling class, the lawyers, and to put into their hands all branches of the government. Ooh, there's that special relationship again, huh? Oh, here's a nice little quip. The people of Russia have provided in their constitution that every person over 18 years of age can vote if they are engaged in some useful employment, and have thus, in my opinion, disfranchised the lawyer. For a lawyer spends the first half of his life over the past, and the last half of his life trying to apply the past to the present, and lets the future go to hell. And I submit this is not a useful occupation. Lawyers should be excluded from the bench and from every legislative assembly. A well-trained lawyer is unfitted for doing anything else except defending the cases that he is hired to defend, and he should be compelled to stick to that. Above all, he should not be entrusted with any share in the direction of public affairs. So there you go. Chapter 11, The Lawyers. And boy, what an interesting role they've played in the creation of our government and the operations of the government and the situation we find ourselves in today. Pretty unbelievable. I don't know if you've ever heard that story. I never have. But, you know, damn, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? We should start maybe tackling these lawyers. Maybe it's a problem. I don't know. Let me know what you think. Leave a comment on the website, or I'm sure this will get posted to YouTube. Leave a comment. I'll check it out.
As always, you've been listening to the File and Claw Audiobook Archive presentation of Triumphant Plutocracy, a.k.a. Imperial Washington, The Story of American Public Life from 1870 to 1920 by Richard Franklin Pettigrew. And as always, this is the information that you're not supposed to know about.